This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
It's Friday, April the 5th, and you are very welcome to the Inside Politics Wrap of the Week from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan, Jack Horgan-Jones and Cormac McQuinn are here. Gentlemen, you're very welcome.
Hello, Hugh.
Hi, Hugh.
There is much to talk about because we didn't really touch on domestic politics so far this week. It's a historic week, or I'm not sure, Jack. Maybe next week is a historic week. Fine Gael Ardesh is tomorrow. Simon Harris will be addressing the nation as well as his party, I suppose. It'll be live on television. Yeah. And then just a couple of short days later, he becomes Taoiseach.
Yeah. Was it a historic week? I mean, emphatically not. Myself and Cormac have been going around in circles this week.
Explain that to us. Is it a holding pattern thing going on?
With the notable exception of Simon Coveney saying he's not going to seek to be selected in the next cabinet. That is an important story. But this was the week that, had there been a contest for the Fine Gael leadership, this is where there would have been hustings, I think. Was there hustings?
There was hustings planned hustings.
Planned hustings this week and last week. And
I think the voting would have been happening this week.
The counting of the vote would have been yesterday and today. So it would have been kind of...
would have been very exciting. It would have messed up our podcast.
It would have messed up our podcast, but it would have at least given us something to cover beyond endless parlour games on, you know, fantasy cabinet selection and just, you know.
I mean, has the fantasy cabinet changed at all in the last 2 weeks? And the same names have been out there are still out there.
This is just going to be a totally unrestrained rant from me and Cormac about how all there is.
How terrible your job is.
No, not necessarily that, but just that, like, things have been entirely circular for a week and we've all just been kind of reporting who's joining Simon Harris's backroom team,
which is a pretty beltway. Because you had this incredibly fast thing. Leo Fraker came out, shocked the whole country. Within 24 hours, we knew that Harris was going to be the leader. I seem to remember, Cormac, when Varadkar gave his speech, he kind of laid out, this is why I'm doing this now, because there's this window now where the party can reflect and, you know, have a presumably a relatively vigorous debate, and then reveal the new leader.
It was a good timetable if there was going to be a contest.
Okay.
The contest wouldn't have dragged on forever. It would have been finished in time for the big Ardesh speech tomorrow, Saturday, and then new Taoiseach when the Dáil resumes after the Easter recess on Tuesday. It was actually brilliantly timed if there was going to be a contest, but we know that in the space of a morning, Simon Harris had wrapped up enough support to blow anyone else that was even half considering it out of the water, and it was all over. So we've just had 2 weeks of talking about how he's going to go back to basics. There's going to be more on law and order. There's going to be small businesses and farmers taken care of, and the who's in and who's out of cabinet, which of course, and fairness, Jack mentioned it there, Simon Coveney saying he's not putting his name forward next week for cabinet made it legit to go back into it this week for sure, because it was something that actually happened, which we were all very grateful for on whether it was Tuesday or Wednesday or whenever it was.
Yes, they're fighting for scraps, really, aren't you?
Well, see, the problem is there's probably as little as maybe four people who know what Simon Harris is going to do. One of them is Simon Harris. One of them might be his wife. Maybe two of his top advisors. Do you know what I mean? And they ain't telling.
The other thing is that there would be absolutely no point in that close-knit team around Harris actually giving an indication of what his intention around cabinet is at the moment. I mean, why would you do that before the last minute possible?
And why would you do that before an Ardesh where all of the members would be gathered and either furious that they're not in or delighted that they are, and, you know, that creates, I don't know, space for plotting.
I mean, there are quite a few knowns here, aren't there? We do know Pascal Donoghue's not going anywhere. We do know that Heather Humphreys isn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
So we do know that Helen McEntee looks as if she may be going somewhere, and there are two vacancies to fill. So it isn't if he has a full deck of cards to play with the six Fine Gael
jobs. I think this is the importance of Coveney stepping down, because I think it gives him enough latitude to do enough without actually having to end any careers.
It gives him more space than Leo Varadkar had in December 2022 to refresh the cabinet for sure.
True.
You know, it's comparable to Michael Noonan not putting his name forward in 2017 when Leo Varadkar became leader, so it allowed him a little bit more space, albeit Leo Varadkar was quite conservative in his selections at that point, and his cabinet very much looked like Enda Kenny's cabinet. But it gives him a little bit more space, but not a great deal.
But it depends on how much. I'm looking for
predictions. Is Helen McEntee moving?
Oh, predictions, are we really doing that? We spend so much time in this podcast talking about how politics is dynamic and unpredictable, and then we're like, can you make your predictions?
Answer the question.
Notwithstanding that. Okay, right. I think that my current thinking, which is subject to further revision and has changed since just yesterday, but if I was a betting man, I would say maybe Helen McEntee's sideways into Enterprise. One of Peter Burke or Jennifer Carey McNeil into Justice. One of those two or Patrick O'Donovan into Higher Education. With an outside bet on Neil Richmond, but I certainly don't think you can promote both him and Jennifer Carey McNeil. It'd be too much that. And then you're looking at another few. I think Hildegard Knockton will stay where she is. And then I think you're looking at a few of the juniors. Alan Dillon to become junior minister, maybe Emer Higgins.
So there are the elements that go into those decisions are, I suppose, you know, first of all, what jobs are available. Second, who is available. Third, how competent are those people. Fourth, where are they in the country? And fifth, what is their level of loyalty to the new leader?
Your question, how competent they are, or is it geography? And so, like, you know, geography can often trump a lot of other things in these considerations. There are two big gaps in cabinet in terms of Fine Gael ministers. Actually, in ministers in general, there is no senior minister from Connacht, full stop, which is a gap. But for Fine Gael, more importantly, maybe Fine Gael, with the departure of Simon Coveney, won't have a senior minister in all of Munster, which would... It might give Patrick O'Donovan in Limerick a bit of a boost. But, you know, having said that, by rights, it should always be on merit rather than geography. So we'll see what way Simon Harris goes. He'll claim it's merit anyway. But
if he doesn't take cognizance of that geography, it does play into this narrative, this criticism, one within Fine Gael as well, which is it's too Dublin-focused, East Coast.
I think Fine Gael lost something like 20 seats in Munster between 2011 and 2016. There is an opportunity there if he wants to take it to make sure there is a Cork minister at the very least. Colin Burke is a backbench TD from Cork North Central. Yeah. So he would be an easy one to slot into one of the probably three junior minister posts that he'll have a vacant. So that's one potential solution.
I mean, the funny thing is, if we adhere to the strictures of this rough algorithm that everyone has decided must be adhered to of gender, geography and generational overhaul, like... It would spit out very few names if you adhered to all those things. Like, he would have effectively no latitude in choosing, particularly when you consider the percentage of the Fine Gael parliamentary party, which is either, you know, already a former cabinet minister or retiring or both.
But that's the thing about Cork. Colin Burke is the only Fine Gael TD in Cork, I think, that's even contesting the next election. We don't know about Simon Coveney yet. But, you know, otherwise Michael Creed's gone, David Staunton's gone.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have somebody in Cork.
And all that rumbling we heard about maybe getting a couple of people to change their minds who had said that they weren't going to stand at the next election, nothing really has come of that.
Hasn't happened yet. Griffin has kind of knocked that on the head. There's no indication that Charlie Flanagan is changing his mind, nor Richard Bruton. You know, there are some who, I suppose, they're... to be impolite about it, there are older politicians who might genuinely just want to get out at this point anyway, you know. But I suppose the younger crop of the parties that the focus on is, say, Brendan Griffin's already knocked that on the head. Yeah. I don't think John Paul Phelan has given any indication he wants to come back.
If he made an explicit offer of a cabinet position to Griffin, I think he'd have to consider
he'd have to
think about it. But I mean, that like, he hasn't kind of...
But there's your senior minister in Munster, I suppose.
Totally.
But, I mean, we could kind of play this game forever, but looking beyond... But looking beyond these kind of human resources issues to the broader points, Cormac made that point about Simon Harris's speech in Athlone, I think it was, where he, you know, talked about, I suppose, went back to basics in terms of Fine Gael values. Can we expect more of that at the Ardesh speech tomorrow, do you think?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah, small business, rural affairs. I noticed that the Fine Gael press office put out a press release after his meeting with the kind of rural caucus of the party yesterday, saying that he had recommitted himself to rural Ireland. And things like that, I think, are going to form the core of it. You can feel Sinn Féin's disappointment and frustration that he's not talking about housing. I think that may be a conscious choice.
Well, he's going to have to. He'll have to
eventually. You can't pretend it's not there. Yeah. But I think it, like, you know, it shows the direction travel here. It is that kind of back to basics thing. I mean, the question I have is, you know, what kind of actual latitude does he have to put any of this into effect? You know, he's constrained by the programme for government. He's constrained by time, and he's constrained by just the raw politics of the situation he finds himself in. So I just, now is not the time where I think you can kind of build a big new kind of policy departure in any or all of those areas. So you might find himself repackaging or reframing things. You might find him making kind of dramatic gestures in other ways, which is why I think maybe Helen McEntee going sideways might be more likely than not, because it enables him to kind of say, look, here's a hinge point in justice. You know, as part of a reorientation, we're putting a new minister in, and that kind of gets him some way down the road of appearing to overhaul things without actually perhaps changing the substance of anything.
Are there, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the hate speech and hate crime bill, that might be long-fingered or, you know,
put
to sleep, basically. Is that, you know, is that sort of accepted? That's a sort of a signal in a way, isn't it, to one part of his own party and some critics of that bill?
It certainly is, yeah. I mean, there has been a growing grumbling from parts of his own party about the hate speech legislation and other things. But, you know, Charlie Flanagan and Michael Ring coming out saying it should be scrapped altogether.
And what other things?
All night drinking is the way they're terming it, this extension of the licensing laws to allow later openings.
It's a strange target, isn't it? I was really surprised by that.
I think they're worried just that it'll create trouble in rural towns and things like that is the sense I get of it. It is a weird one, in fairness, to bring in along with the hate speech as a thing. Another one is assisted dying,
which
is not
going to
be part of this thing.
There was an Oireachtas Committee report about published about 10 days ago, which recommended the introduction of assisted dying, which is something that exists in a small number of other countries. But
it's too late in this government's term to get it over the line, even if they were inclined to do it at this point.
Are there any other landmines like the hate speech bill left in the programme for government of this sort, of this kind of culture war sort?
I mean, nothing immediately springs to mind. I think that there is a long-running fault line in the government over, you know, roads investment and public transport and versus private transport. And you saw that flicker into life last week with the demand management strategy, brought to cabinet by Eamon Ryan, which has all sorts of scary things in it, like reducing the number of on-street car parking and congestion charges and stuff like that. But like, when you actually drill down into that, that's like a toolkit to be presented, to be first of all consulted on, which is all the cabinet agreed last week, was to do a consultation on it. And then at some point down the line, local authorities can choose from this menu of options, but it happens at the local, not the national level. So that, I think, speaks to a wider truth within the remaining lifetime of the government, which is that they're kind of trying not to do a huge amount. And that was the kind of pre-existing situation that was in place before Leo Varadkar stood down, because they were on a glide path to the election. The more you do, the more chance of a row, the more chance of a schism, the more chance of an election by accident. That kind of comes into conflict with the need, I think, that Simon Harris has to put a political stamp on things while also being restrained by all the factors we talked about earlier.
He's going to look for the quick wins, really, isn't he?
I mean, what would they be?
Things like, I saw coverage of it during the week, you know, this idea that the bringing child minding under the National Childcare Subsidy Scheme would be fast-tracked. Now, fast-tracked, you know, maybe it was going to happen anyway, but I suppose, why not get it done? Why not speed it up if it can be done, I suppose? A quick win. Another thing that's been suggested is this idea that there would be a mandatory minimum sentences of, you know, decades for really serious crimes like murder, where there'd be no chance of parole until after that set period. It's already in place in places like the UK. You know, that is eminently doable. It would speak to the law and order demands within Fine Gael. And another thing they could probably get over the line before the end of this government.
So it seems to be something on PRSI as well for small businesses, which is something that Fine Gael ministers and backbenchers
certainly want. There'll have to be something on small businesses. It's almost all they've talked about for two weeks.
There's this chat about, like, there's a part of government that wants to see a finance bill and a kind of mini budget before summer, but it's not in the ascendancy as far as I can tell. It's resisted by Pascal and McGrath. But McGrath is saying, we're going to see what we can do pre-budget and we're going to see what we can do on PRSI. So I'd be interested to see exactly how that plays out. I mean, they are also putting 250 million quid of a rebate back in businesses' pockets, but there will be something on small businesses. But I suppose when you look at all these things in the aggregate, it's not nothing, but it does feel a little bit around the edges. It doesn't feel like a kind of a fundamental rebranding or, you know, a huge momentum builder, any single measure?
So am I right in saying, Cormac, that Simon Harris has got two new jobs? He's become the leader of Fine Gael and he's about to become the Taoiseach. The first one is more important than the second one because he's got this very short window in which to shore up Fine Gael's support and to perform a little bit better at the next election than people were anticipating. That's his main job.
But it's shorter even than the next election, really, because he's got less than 2 months until the local and European elections.
Do you think he'd be blamed if they have a particularly bad
June election? He probably will get away with that a bit, and he'll certainly be praised if they hold their own or even gain a little bit, perhaps in the local space, maybe more than the European space. But he still doesn't want to have a bad election in less than 2 months into his leadership. You know, he'll want to have a leadership bounce in the polls. You know, so that is the first looming test. But yeah, the big one is the general election, which he says will be March. But I think there's still a lot of people who think it's going to be this autumn.
Last thought on this, Jack. There was always a suggestion, I've been made by Pat Leahy in the studio a couple of times, that that as this government neared its end, that strains between the three parts of it might become more evident as they felt the need to make their individual pitch to the electorate, while at the same time not falling out entirely, because that would, you know, possibly, you know, destroy the chances of the government continuing or some version of it continuing after the next election. Does all this stuff, the change in leadership, the bit of a reshuffle, the attempt by Fine Gael to refocus itself to some extent, does that increase the chances of that?
It does, yeah. I wouldn't overplay it. There was certainly a wobble ran around the circle immediately after Varadkar stood down, and there was a concern at cabinet level from the two other parties that, you know, Harris might kind of cut and run and go quickly, particularly if he got a bounce. A couple of things there. We've only had one round of polling in the Sunday Independent, I think it was, and there was no huge bounce evident. I think a 2% increase. So, you know, no massive grounds to go to the country there. And then secondly, he kind of recommitted himself to the stance of Leo Varadkar quite quickly, met with the two leaders of the other coalition parties and kind of reaffirmed in the broadest sense possible the intention to go full term. So I think that those concerns kind of took a bit of a backseat. And, you know, there seems to be a view out there as well that, like, he'll give himself the longest run in possible to try and do as much, or create the impression of doing as much as possible before going to the country. So I think it's still worth watching the local and Europeans for just how the parties compete against each other. You know, they're not bound at local level, certainly anyway, by the programme for government, so they can kind of take pot shots at each other. I think that'll be a bit of a perhaps leading edge indicator for how they differentiate each other from each other. In the general, and yeah, I think the truth is unchanged, that as we get closer to when an election must happen, they do need to start differentiating from each other. But is that fundamentally changed by Harris becoming Taoiseach?
We're straight into campaigning mode now, aren't we? It's time for the campaigns to start for the Europeans
that's,
and the locals.
That's something that the party leaders have been doing this week while the Dáil is in recess. We see Mary Lou MacDonald and Micheál Martin both in Limerick in recent days on the mayoral election trail, but also with their local election candidates in those places. Simon Harris is making a number of stops, I think, on the way to his Ardesh in Galway, where he'll be meeting local candidates. And, you know, we're in it now.
It's started. Yeah.
It's on.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Right. And we'll certainly be covering that over the next while too. We're covering lots of things over the next while. After the break, we're going to be talking about Northern Irish politics. So I should mention that we are actually going to Belfast next week. I'll be in the MAC in Belfast next Wednesday, April the 10th, along with Pat Leahy and our Northern editor, Freya McClements, and with Lisa Clare Whitten, who's just written a book about the constitution of Northern Ireland. And we're also going to be joined by Alex Kane, who's a regular columnist in the Irish Times, very often on unionist politics, which is a particularly interesting form of politics at the moment, which we'll be discussing after this. This
podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
And you're very welcome back. We've had two earthquakes in Irish politics in the last 2.5 weeks or so. The entirely unexpected resignation of Leo Varadkar was followed 2 weeks later by the entirely unexpected resignation as DUP leader of Geoffrey Donaldson. Donaldson's resignation followed his charging for historic sexual offences, and he's due in court later this month. This is a very delicate subject, and obviously we don't want to say anything that would have any possibility of influencing what might happen in the legal scenario. on. We're certainly not going to touch on that. But it is also a political earthquake, as we said, Jack. What do we make of it? Just a few short weeks after the Assembly was reconstituted, it seems to have been received not with equanimity, but with a certain calm and don't scare the horses by the political establishment in Northern Ireland.
Yes, for the moment. And down here as well, they've kind of poured a bit of oil on troubled waters, certainly initially, and this is partially caught up with the shock relating to the nature of the allegations. People were very concerned about the potential for a destabilising contest within the DUP. Over the days that followed, in Dublin anyway, there was a sense emerging that, you know, certainly an expectation, more than optimism, an expectation that the institutions would continue. And it seems that the DUP is kind of battening down the hatches, that there doesn't seem to, and I'm not the world's closest observer of Northern politics, but talking to a couple of people in that jurisdiction over the last couple of days, the sense seems to be that the DUP is, you know, looking to regroup as opposed to tear itself apart.
Although it is a deeply divided party.
It is a deeply divided party, but that may be in some ways more reason not to tear itself apart now in the aftermath of a big shock. I mean, in some ways there are some parallels just in terms of the political shape and size of what happened to down here. You know, a big shock departure, a party that's not expecting it or in any way ready for a contest, means that they kind of cleave to the centre ground, and it seems that the centre ground from the DP's point of view would look to be in the shape of Gavin Robinson.
Who's the interim leader.
Looks set to remain so. And he, is my understanding, he would kind of follow in the more moderate tradition and footsteps of Geoffrey Robinson. So you wouldn't see, you know, one of the more kind of militant wings of the DUP enter into the ascendancy, which again would favour the continuation of the institutions. But look, it's remarkably febrile and volatile, and obviously it looks like you have a UK general election around July time, I think it is. So that may further prove to be a destabilising factor. But they've made it through the first couple of weeks.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so, for the moment, I'm looking at some analysis of this, Cormac, and I suggest, I mean, that the current leadership of the DUP now, with Gavin Robinson as the interim leader and then as Deputy First Minister, you have Emma Little-Pengelly. They are both, could be described as Donaldson loyalists. I mean, Little-Pengelly in particular, you know, wouldn't even be the Assembly if she hadn't been co-opted into the seat that Donaldson didn't take at the last Assembly election and then was elevated to the leadership of the Assembly party. So she looks particularly potentially vulnerable should there be some kind of a shake-up. And I see some of the analysis saying that the critics, the anti-Donaldson wing of the party, which is particularly strong in the Westminster Parliamentary Party, I think, people like Ian Paisley Jr., Sammy Wilson and people like that, that they're just going to hold their fire for the moment, but that, you know, there could be trouble further down the line.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one reason that they might do so is they would be tasked with a decision to make of whether to pull out of the deal that saw the restoration of power sharing or to go along with the deal that was struck by Donaldson, which they may not want to get involved in, which means that, you know, it very much favours the moderate wing of the party keeping things ticking over. I think there would be relief in Dublin, Belfast and London that all of this happened after power sharing was restored rather than beforehand, because it could have thrown into all sorts of turmoil had this happened sooner. It seems like it'll be, it's hard to say with the North, but it seems like it'll be steady as she goes, albeit with the looming Westminster elections being potentially difficult on the horizon.
Is there a broader picture that it feeds into a sense that unionism is increasingly weakened, increasingly divided, fractious, turned against itself? I mean, it could go very badly at the next general election for Westminster. You know, Robinson himself, you know, his seat is under threat in East Belfast from Alliance. The seat which Donaldson currently holds is also under a threat from Alliance. If they lost a couple of those seats, you know, there's a whole question about, you know, the state of unionism. And I'm not sure, no matter what some people might think, whether Irish nationalism in its various forms would benefit from a completely fractured unionism.
Yeah, Newton Emerson was writing about this a bit during the week. Because it does seem to be that, you know, at any time there's a bit of a crisis in unionism, people talk about unionist realignment and, you know, whether there is going to be some kind of merger, because it seems that unionism is not really big enough to support all the parties that
sort
exist.
So two and a half parties. Which
yeah,
have
two and a half parties, the UP, UUP, TV. So I suppose the question is now, is now the time for something dramatic to happen in the wake of something dramatic happening. And I'd encourage people to read Newton's piece, because he's basically saying, and the headline encapsulates it perfectly, you know, they're not about to merge. It's hard enough to hold them together individually. And you see that in microcosm in what's happened in the DUP after Geoffrey Donaldson stepped down as leader. You know, there are two or at least three different wings within the DUP.
And he makes a very interesting point, which will appeal to techie political nerds, which is that it's particularly difficult to run a party which has to compete both in first past the post elections for Westminster and proportional representation, single transferable vote ones in the Assembly, because they're two very, very different dynamics. So while the various unionist parties are able to coalesce around, I suppose, what you might call the sectarian divide when it comes to a contest in somewhere like Fermanagh, they can't do that in
he makes this point about Fermanagh and South Tyrone, where unionism regained this quite marginal, ultra-marginal, actually, he calls it, seat by running in a Greek candidate in the Westminster elections, but that you just can't do that in PRSDB because it's too kind of dynamic and hard to predict. So, yeah, look, it's just one of the many ways in which Northern politics has to contort itself into a variety of different shapes.
One of the things that struck me about that piece, though, was the suggestion that at press conferences with unionist parties in the North, one of the frequent questions is, are you going to merge? Mm. Which very much reminded me of the Labour Social Democrat situation down here, albeit there are somewhat higher stakes for the unionist community
up north.
You know, but I was amused by that. And to my shame, it's something that hadn't occurred to me. But of course, that's a question that would be asked, it's maybe not on my radar as much as, given the less focus we would have on events in the North.
There's also this interesting dynamic as well. He relates this anecdote where after Geoffrey Donaldson was beaten to the DUP leadership by Edwin Poots in 2021, he had a private meeting with Doug Beattie, who's the Ulster Unionist Party leader. Mm. And when this came out in 2022, Doug Beattie said he basically left with the impression that Donaldson was considering defecting back to the DUP, and Donaldson said, nothing of the sort. Totally different impression.
A former UUP member himself, of course.
I think any potential talks of mergers, there's
just a last question on this to tie it back to what we were talking about before the break. Simon Harris, and youngest Taoiseach ever, doesn't necessarily have a huge track record in what you might call the big, heavy-hitting cabinet responsibilities, foreign affairs, finance, whatever. Little unclear maybe where he'd be coming from, whether there'd be any change in the approach to the North. Because one of the things about this coalition's approach to the North, struck me, is it's kind of turned upside down what people expected usually out of where Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil would stand. You know, Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney are much more disliked, or at least there are more expressions of dislike about them.
That's
in the unionist community.
That's a legacy of the Brexit stuff as well.
Exactly, whereas Micheál Martin is, I think it's fair to say, seen as being somewhat more emollient in his position on things like Shared Ireland and things like that. There's a bit of a topsy-turvy
approach. You can see that going back, despite Fianna Fáil being a Republican party. You know, Bertie Ahern was always, he always seemed to get on well with the unionist community. I guess Simon Harris is something of an unknown quantity to politicians in the North at this point. You know, he'd have met, while he was Minister for Health, his counterpart up there at that time. You know, that sort of thing. There would have been links like that. But how green he is on the national issue or the constitutional question and all of that.
Green as in nationalist or green as in inexperienced?
Perhaps both. But I mean, it strikes me as a 37-year-old, it'd be very easy for him to answer the, you know, do you expect to see a United Ireland in your lifetime question? You know, he's got a good 5 or 6 decades which that could happen, I suppose.
Is this where advisors are important and who's around?
This is one of the interesting ones. So Leo Varadkar had a dedicated advisor on the North in the form of Jim Darcy, former senator. And certainly the soundings from the Harris camp, it was last week at this stage, were that they wouldn't be keeping on someone dedicated in the Northern Irish role. And talking to a couple of people north of the border, there was a little bit of uncertainty about that, partially because Harris is a bit of an unknown entity when it comes to the North.
So we might expect Micheál Martin to even more be taking the lead.
Being the ascend, yeah. I think that may well be the case. But I don't think you can rely on your Minister for Foreign Affairs and Taoiseach, notwithstanding all the status that brings. If you're Taoiseach, you got to be there in the North.
Okay. Now, as usual, at this time, we pick interesting articles from IrishTimes.com over the course of the week. And actually, Cormac, your one has a Northern or Irish unity tinge to it, as well as a report we carried yesterday from Mark Hennessy.
Yeah, I mean, this question always sets the cat among the pigeons, but this is the latest study on the estimated costs of unification. It was done on behalf of the IIEA, the Institute of International European Affairs, and it estimated that the costs could be as high as 20 billion per year to the Irish Exchequer if there was unification. That's under a scenario where the welfare rates and public pay sector pay would match what's happening in the
South.
That
is an awful lot of money.
That's a lot of money. I mean, our entire budget of a year, I think, is in the region of 85, 88 sort of billion euros. So you're talking a quarter of that every year for 20 years, I think, was the target. Talk of 25% tax increases. I don't think that would be terribly popular south of the border. Now, Sinn Féin were very, very quick to come out and dispute the premise of a lot of
and
this stuff.
To a whole bunch of other academic surveys.
I mean, there have been many in this department. All of them get accused of leaving various factors out. You know, Sinn Féin would say that, you know, you're not taking into account that the subvention from Westminster is possibly less than has been projected, less than the 12 billion that's always suggested, because we're paying pension costs that, you know, presumably the British government would still have to pay because people made their social security payments in the UK, you know, the cost of contributing to the UK Defence Forces, all of that sort of stuff wouldn't factor in. And then there's always the argument that partition has created economic stagnation in the North, and it would be turbocharged should the British leave, which is a point of view put forward by Pater Tobin of A2. So, you know, it always creates a big debate, but it was very interesting.
It is a subject of great interest to us, and obviously, you know, we've had our North and South project going and Common Ground going under Mark Hennessy
He did a second piece looking at German reunification and the lessons, I suppose.
Brendan O'Leary has talked in here about, you know, other examples around the world and what works and what doesn't work, and the German unification one is rather chilling, because in a way that's the model, really, I think.
Well, that's being talked about in this report. Talk, it took 30 years for kind of pay and pensions and levels to equalise across East and West Germany. So the sense is that Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland in that scenario wouldn't have that long to wait, hence the massive costs.
I mean, there's an element here of you just don't know, isn't there? But there is also, I mean, I was just struck by, Jack, you know, just reading kind of the letters to the editor in today's newspaper in response to this. And there were a lot of people who seemed to have taken the hump at the fact that the report had been done in the first place. And they were saying, you know, maybe we should get rid of Donegal as well, because that cost us money. That'd be a subject for another podcast, I think. But you really need to start discussing this nitty gritty if the thing is properly on the agenda.
Yeah, it was an interesting position for Sinn Féin and for others in the Nationalist kind of Republican community, where they had to welcome this, because one of the main things that Sinn Féin is saying, and they're not wrong, is that, you know, we have to start thinking more closely and carefully about the ramifications of potential Irish unity, and we had to start doing the academic study on it. But not like this, not with this answer, because they know that, like, look, I can understand why they're frustrated, because I'm sure, not being an accountant, but I'm sure, you know, accountants and economists can make the numbers kind of tell whatever story they want in some ways. You know, there's always a way of slicing it. And this idea of 20 billion a year for 20 years, I mean, that is the kind of thing that cuts to the core of, you know, soft, certainly support south of the border
for a third of a bank bailout every year.
Yeah,
for 20 years.
And we've seen this in the Aaron's polling that we've done in the Irish Times, you know, where people are kind of like, yeah, I'd love United Ireland, it'd be brilliant. Wouldn't cost me anything, would it? All of a sudden, when people are given this other piece of information, it kind of fades away quite quickly.
The other angle as well, which often gets rolled out from the Republican side, which is, there'll be savings through, you know, reducing the duplication in the public service north and south of the border. Like, I mean, the public sector in Northern Ireland is huge. They are all people who have jobs, who pay their mortgage, who have families to feed. You know, that there are many things that,
I mean,
could be unpopular
kind of
about this
as the view from Dublin. But actually, what really might matter is the view from Belfast. Belfast, you know, and if you make a comparison with what happened in the Scottish independence referendum, you know, that some of the numbers that came out, some of the number crunching that was done in the last couple of weeks before that, definitely had an effect on the
outcome. Because
you can't
be sure. And the other thing is that, like, you can't just do a desktop exercise on these things, I suspect. Like, I mean, that's not to cast aspersions on what the two academics have done. But, like, I suppose maybe it goes to show that a desktop exercise can give a scary number. But ultimately, whatever number was to be arrived at would also be the product of political deal making as well, you know. So yeah. that's the unknown dimension.
Indeed. My article is a great scoop by Naomi O'Leary in this week's Irish Times about a Libyan warlord, Khalifa Haftar is his name. He controls a lot of eastern Libya, and he's supported by, I think, the Turks and the Russians. He's supported by the Wagner Group, lovely people, and is also getting service from former members of the Irish Defence Forces and the Army Rangers, and Naomi broke this, including quite possibly people who had not even fully left active service with the Defence Forces, which is kind of shocking. And there are other worrying elements about this, including photographs you see of these trainers in situ in Libya wearing Irish insignia or what looks like Irish flags, which is all kinds of, you know, worrying implications. It's a really good, it broke a really good exclusive story, and fair play to her for that. Jack, you were reading Justine McCarthy.
Yeah, Justine McCarthy's piece today is talking about the kind of political weaponization of NGOs, or the idea of NGOs being in some ways kind of bad faith political actors that occurred during the referendum. And it's something I noticed as well, and I think it's something that, I was talking to a couple of people in the NGO community after the referendums, I think it's something that they're wary of as well, of their work and them as entities becoming kind of politically targeted or seen as overtly political actors. And of course they're bound by the McKenna judgment and other strictures.
The McKenna judgment, which restricts any state-funded organisation from participating on one side or another of a referendum campaign.
Yeah, and because a lot of them do take state funding, but, you know, the argument is that you can kind of build a Chinese wall between your state funding, your non-state funding, and participate with your non-state funding. But the whole debate over whether they were or they weren't, they said they weren't, the no side kind of shaped to suggest that they were. And certainly the strong suggestion was that had there been a no-no in the referendum campaigns, that you may have seen some kind of court challenge that was kind of filtering around in the days running into the vote, that the no campaign would have kind of taken a court challenge. But to take a step back from it, I just think it's an interesting dynamic that Justine has lighted on and is writing about.
What do you think about it? I mean, I thought her piece was very interesting, and she gave very powerful examples of people who have just been, you know, getting appalling harassment and treatment, and kind of retired from social media and all that kind of, you know, terrible stuff, which is to be deplored. But there is a valid political debate, isn't there? And it, you know, it did crop up, I think, quite legitimately in the wake of the referendums about, you know, is there too close a relationship between the government and certain non-governmental organisations, which it both funds and takes advice from, and in some cases is lobbied for, that it creates a kind of a, you know, a bubble, for want of a better word?
Yeah, I think it cuts both ways. I mean, you know, going back for several governments, I remember that the occupant of the Custom House, the Minister for Housing, could occasionally be very frustrated by the fact that NGOs would criticise government policy and housing, but also take money from the government, you know. And so I'm not so sure that it's so necessarily straightforward that you take the money from the government and you become part of a kind of insider bubble that reinforces each other's talking points. But I think the very fact that that suggestion is being made and is gaining currency and traction is something that the NGOs themselves should be wary of. And, you know, sometimes they do go on the radio and shoot from the hip and kind of offer an opinion proffered as fact. And I think they have to prepare themselves for a future in which they're invigilated and challenged on that more closely, which in some ways is no bad thing. But it's definitely an interesting development that, like, all of a sudden NGOs, NGOism and the funding and the suggestion that there's an insider cozy cabal, you know, if that's travelling, that's interesting.
It's also, and this is a bit of a tangent, but isn't it also an argument for why they really shouldn't be looking at Exchequer funding for RTE? You know,
yeah.
It's just, there will always be a suspicion among certain people that there will be influence brought to bear on broadcasting and all of that. I mean, it's definitely a strong argument against that.
Even the supposition of it, or just the being able to make the argument, is kind of...
That is a huge tangent. That's three more podcasts you've just opened up there. I was just going to ask you, do you look forward to going to an Ardèche because you're down to Galway tomorrow for the Fine Gael?
Well, you know, I am, yeah. I mean, myself and up to 2,000 Fine Gaelers, provided Storm Kathleen doesn't dump in all of her fury on Simon Harris's head. There's an orange weather warning in Galway where it's inauspicious, isn't it?
I mean, in a hotel,
certainly
low-hanging
fruit for the colour riders.
Well,
anyway,
Marion Lord is going. It might be too obvious a metaphor or whatever, depending on how the Ardèche goes. But there's lots of stuff up. There's 200 motions, everything from tax cuts to Ireland should be providing lethal aid to Ukraine. There should be premium pay for workers in Dublin. There should be more childcare provided at primary schools. There's lots of stuff going on. All of the junior ministerial possible cabinet contenders have their own roles in terms of chairing some of these debates and stuff. I don't think anyone has been left out. I haven't looked at it totally forensically, but they'll all have their moments.
Is it fun?
Fine Gael, they're busy. Fine Gael have a habit of scheduling rolling doorsteps every hour and a half or every 2 hours or so, which keeps us all very busy and not up to mischief doing other things chatting to people that they mightn't want us chatting to.
It's very clever. They have a deliberate strategy to keep the hacks away from the politicians.
But they also put the ministers in front of you, it'll be busy. I think it will be interesting. There'll always be a few mad things that comes out of these debates that they have, and then there's the big speech, which it is I suppose the most important speech of Simon Harris's career so far.
Well, stay safe in the storm anyway, Cormac. No unnecessary journeys. That's the Galway message always,
absolutely,
isn't it? We will leave it there for today. Thanks to Jack and to Cormac, to our producer John Casey and our engineer JJ Vernon. We will be back with you next week with a new Taoiseach. Talk to you then.